until it reaches the freezing floor of his lost sense of self. He has wanted this for her so much. He has written a long letter to Marina Petrovna, explaining everything, no doubt. Anna's talent, the impossibility of her studying as she should be studying, his own guilt. Does he really know her well enough to spill all this out to her? Yes, he knows her well enough. "What did you write?" she asks more gently. "Nothing," he says. "It was just a note. I thought Marina Petrovna would like to know how you're getting on. She would remember you. And she was very close to your mother."
"Was she?"
"Of course. I thought you knew that."
"But was she really close to my mother?"
"I don't think so. She wrote letters to my parents with both their names on. My father always passed the letter to Vera so that she could read it first, and she would tap the envelope on the table and raise her eyebrows and then hand it back to him unopened. It's you she writes to, isn't it?" Anna stops. She's almost pushed her bike straight past the gate. Perhaps she didn't really want to find it. Marina Petrovna Berezovskaya is one of those legends everyone knows and no one talks about. But she's also her father's friend Marina, who wrote letters her mother didn't want to read.
"Isn't she your friend as well, Mammy?"
"Not really. She's your father's friend. He's known her for a long time."
"But she wants to be your friend, or she wouldn't write to you."
"I dare say. But friendship doesn't work like that." Chapter 4. The creak of the gate flushes out a pair of wood-pigeons from the birch scrub. The birds go up, clattering their wings, and then settle again on a branch 20 feet above Anna's head. "Brr-coo," they say. "Brr-coo," as they smooth away the noise she's made. The path is so narrow that she'd be better off leaving her bike here, just inside the wall where it can't be seen. Anna is prickling with excitement now. In a few minutes she'll be at the dacha. Marina Petrovna will be in front of her. Anna has studied a dozen photographs, trying to become objective, trying to separate the woman she is going to draw from the woman who was her parents' friend, her father's friend. There she stands, in a pale dress, beside a chair where her father sits. Here she is in trousers, crouched over a pail of berries, looking up. The sun must be bright because she's shielding her eyes. Anna's father is slightly out of focus behind her. He looks young. Another photograph shows Vera and Marina Petrovna together, side by side, but Vera seems to be pulling away, as if she'll be gone as soon as the shutter clicks. These photographs, with many others, are pasted into her father's scrapbooks. He ought to get rid of them. A bramble snags on Anna's arm. The path is overgrown, and the trees are loaded with ivy and wild clematis. Anna treads softly, as if someone is listening. In the green rankness of the trees, she catches shadows making faces. The path turns, and turns again. She might go on like this forever, making her way soundlessly towards the house on this perfect summer morning. She might never reach it at all. After weeks or months, someone might find her bike, with its tires sagging into the dust. But not a trace of Anna anywhere. Not a note, not a bone, not a scrap of her clothing. Like all those others. Anna glances down at the crumpled sheet of instructions. "Follow the path to a second gate." The second gate. Even more ramshackle than the first, this one is hanging off its hinges. Briars have closed around it. She steps over the gap. There is more light coming through the trees. Fir gives way to birch. There is rowan and cherry. Sun streams between the tree trunks onto last year's fallen skeletal leaves. There is an acrid smell of fox. Anna stops. So far she's been heading uphill, but from here tracks spill in all directions. Some of them are animal tracks. Surely there must be an easier way to the dacha. Perhaps she's testing you. Marina Petrovna's face rises in Anna's mind. The sweep of her eyelids, the lift of her cheekbones, the downward glance. Her beauty is cool, not warm. Black hair, dark eyes, pale skin. She is said to have had a Tartar grandfather. They could slam that head against a cell wall. They might still. Think of what happened to Professor Kozlovsky. They let him out, but he'd gone crazy. He couldn't give lectures anymore. Now the trees are thinning. The path must be coming out on top of the hill. Yes. Yes, a clearing, a thicket of lilacs, and through them the grey, quiet bulk of Berezovskaya's dacha. Anna slips through the lilacs. A veranda runs the length of the house. There's a door, and it's half open. She's expected. Marina Petrovna is dressed in a cream-coloured wrapper as if she's just finished taking off her stage makeup at the end of a play. She is smoking nervously. Anna, she says, taking Anna's hands, searching her face as if for something she recognises. She's too close, and the smell of her perfume makes Anna uneasy.
I've been waiting for you.
I'm not late, am I?
No, you're not late. But I don't see many people. It's always a shock, so I prepare myself.
The hand which holds the cigarette is trembling slightly. Her skin has a parchment look, and her curly black hair is greying.
I know, I'm looking older. Country air is supposed to be good for you, but I'm not so sure.
She smiles and takes another drag at her cigarette, half closing her eyes.
And you've grown up, Anna. I can still call you Anna, can't I?
Of course you can.
You must have been 15 or 16 when I last saw you.
16. I'm 23 now.
And your father tells me you work as a nursery teacher.
I'm not qualified to teach. I'm an assistant, that's all.
But you draw. I've seen your work. It's good.
I'm an amateur. I've no training.
You've come. That's what matters.
Her voice is exactly as Anna remembers it.
Come and see the house, and then you can decide where you want to draw me.
They walk together from room to room. Upstairs there are two bedrooms, and Marina Petrovna opens the shutters wide in each, so that they spring from gloom into light. The wooden floors are polished, but the rooms have a dry, unopened smell.
It's bright in here at this time of day, isn't it? I'd forgotten.
The light flows over the face, neither cruel nor kind, but accurate. The skin that looked so velvety in the photographs is drier now, stretched over bones. She lights another cigarette, draws the smoke deep, lets it trickle out. The light's good in here, says Anna. Marina Petrovna pauses and looks around the room with her eyes narrowed to see what Anna sees. There's very little furniture. A faded blue sofa, a rug, a stove, a window seat. The walls are cream, the wood dark. Now that the shutters are open, Anna can see how high the dacha stands. From here, you look out over forest to a line of shallow blue hills. Marina Petrovna goes to the window and stares out. Her hand slides up and down the satiny wood of the window frame. Anna knows that this is the room. This is where she comes, to sit on that sofa or in the window seat, to look out at the distance. This is her place. Anna's gaze flickers round the room, fast, excited, scenting possibilities. That big mirror above the fireplace, which is on the wall opposite the window. If you pulled the sofa forward and she sat just here, with her back to the mirror. I want to try something, Marina Petrovna. Is it all right to move the sofa? She nods. Anna drags it forward, pulls it to the angle she wants. Could you sit on here for a moment? She sits, with a stiffness which shows how little she likes being told what to do. She's on the edge of the sofa, knees together, dissociating herself from her own body, as if to say, this is your idea, not mine. Anna's taken things too quickly. But here is the composition, exactly as she'd known it would be. The reflection, the back of her head, her arm lying across the back of the sofa, and beyond it the line of forest, bluer and more enigmatic in the mirror than face to face, and yet clearer, too.
I don't want to be drawn sitting down, she says.
Anna looks again at the curve of Marina Petrovna's arm against the sofa's rough blue cloth. It is perfect. Marina Petrovna stands. It feels wrong. She isn't going to be shifted on this one.
These early moments are dangerous, when a sitter recognizes that you haven't just come to mirror her. You've come to penetrate. You're a threat to her private world. And with Marina Petrovna, it will be more difficult than usual. She's used to controlling the way she's seen. "A standing pose is tiring," says Anna.
"I don't mind that. We can have breaks, I suppose."
"Of course."
Anna shoves the sofa back against the wall.
Marina Petrovna remains standing, in a pose that isn't a pose at all. Arms loose at her sides, head plumb straight to the line of neck and spine. She's right. This is how she should stand. She came into the world with so much that everyone wanted. All she ever had to do was enter a room and offer herself. It doesn't matter that years have passed, or that her skin is fading and her hair going grey. The curve of her lips suggests that happiness will begin any moment.
"I'll do some preliminary sketches," says Anna, "just to get the pose and the room, the basic composition. Can you stay like that for 20 minutes?
"Of course."
Anna draws quickly, making thumbnail composition sketches as Marina Petrovna relaxes into the pose. She'll be disappointed when she sees these sketches. Sitters always are. They want the likeness, and they won't get it yet. They hate being a shape among other shapes.
It needs something more, but Anna doesn't know what yet.
She draws on.
Lilac. A bowl of lilac, on that table where the mirror will double it.
"There," says Anna. "That's it for the moment. Rest."
Marina Petrovna looks closely at the sketches, where her face is a blank disc. Then she says,
"It's going to be good."
"Yes," says Anna. But at this moment she doesn't care. She's swamped by the tiredness she always feels on starting a new piece of work. The thrust of beginning will land her somewhere she doesn't want to be. She can only get free by drawing her way out of it.
"After all, you're the one who has to live with it," Anna says at last.
Marina Petrovna looks startled.
"The drawing, I mean."
"Yes."
"Yes, of course." She walks to the window. Anna watches her outlined against the light. She knows Anna's watching, but it doesn't make her self-conscious. She's grown up with being watched.
Everyone Anna has ever drawn has been nervous at first. Perhaps they're afraid that she'll prize out hidden things and put them down on paper for everyone to see. But Anna would say that the best portraits don't work like that. They're not about exposure. They're about recognition. Anna wouldn't voice her theories aloud because she's an amateur and untrained and hasn't the right to speak. She is trying to work her way towards what she thinks. But it's hard work, and drawing itself is hard enough. The line cuts its way down the paper like the arm of a swimmer doing butterfly stroke. It looks easy, but how the arm aches afterwards. There's something each sitter doesn't like about herself, or himself. Luba screeched when she saw the sketches Anna had done.
"My God, Anna Mikhailovna, is my bum really that big?"
"You were bending over to mop the floor," Anna pointed out.
She had loved the line of Luba's spread, straining haunches. She would have liked to draw her naked. But Luba continued to gape at the paper, offended and fascinated. Her father said, his voice light but pained, "Are my lips really as thin as that, Anna?" "I never knew I did that with my hands." "Are my eyes as glassy as you've drawn them?" "I thought I was smiling."
But what is a portrait but the scrutiny of light on form? When Anna first read this, she didn't understand it at all, but now she likes to repeat it to herself. Light on form. Light on form. Elizaveta Antonovna, filling in her reports. Light on form. The children racing in the playground, their screams rising into the air like winter smoke. Light on form. Her father's hand hanging at his side while he reads. Light on form.
"We'll have tea," says Marina Petrovna. "I've got some cherry jam my Nana made last season. You must be hungry."
She doesn't grow any food, realizes Anna, leaning out of the window and scanning the overgrown garden. Not so much as a bunch of herbs. How can she manage?
And then I'll sit for you.
You mean stand, Marina Petrovna?
Yes, I mean stand.
But now I want you to tell me all about your father.
What does he think of the situation?
The situation?
Marina Petrovna draws herself up. She counts on her fingers, snapping out the names. Poland, France, the Scandinavian countries, Greece, Austria, Belgium. Need I go on?
Oh, I see. Yes, I see, thinks Anna. But I've got Kolya to think of, and the nursery children. And I've got to find a way of keeping rabbits out of the lettuces and pickling enough cabbage for the winter and keeping Dad from getting too depressed. And Kolya's grown out of his shoes again, and he needs vitamins, and the girls in white dresses have graduated while I can't. I simply can't think about everything else on top of that.
We're at peace, she says. We have a pact with them.
Chapter 5. The green and gold evening passes like 100 others. It seems nothing special at the time. Anna's tired after the bike ride back, with a long detour to avoid the dogs at the Tutayev farm. She's washed away dust and sweat, put on her favourite green cotton dress, and made a casserole of potatoes and anchovies. Kolya and her father are late back from fishing, but it doesn't matter. The casserole will be a little crisper on top, that's all.
Anna! She hears Kolya shouting through the garden. Anna, we got two real beauties!
The fish are brown trout. She could wrap them in wet muslin and they'd last until tomorrow, but she decides that for once they're going to have a real feast. Casserole first, then the trout, fried in butter. Her father has already cleaned the fish, and they lie on the kitchen table with the patient, helpful look a trout takes on after its death. If only she'd known at the time how important every detail of that evening was going to become. Kolya boasting that the trout he'd caught had been this one, the fatter of the two. Her father, sunburnt and relaxed after his day at the lake. The taste of the trout. Anna peels back the salty, delicate crust of scales. Each of them dips forkfuls of trout flesh into the foaming butter Anna has swirled around the pan. And her father says, as he does every summer,
"There's nothing like fresh caught fish. By the time it gets to market, half the flavour's gone."
Sharp, smoky taste of anchovies. Potatoes rich and savoury with anchovy oil. A handful of early lettuce. Kolya's red lips greasy with butter as he reaches for another chunk of bread to wipe round his plate. No, she doesn't really notice any of it. After Kolya's gone to bed, she and her father drink tea on the veranda. He smokes while they talk, and a warm breeze shivers the birch leaves. Plumes of flower toss on the lilac, and now its scent is strong. They sit up until long after midnight, because neither of them wants to break the spell of the summer night. The only unusual thing is that when at last her father rises to go to bed, he doesn't shuffle off with a mumbled good night, his shoulders bowed by the thought of the night to come. He stands beside his daughter for a moment, with his hand on her hair.
"What a night, eh?" he says.
"Yes."
"Your mother's roses will be flowering soon."
"Kolya helped me to weed them."
"That's good. That's how it should be."
He strokes her hair again.
"That's how it should be," he repeats. "Well, good night, Anna."
"Good night." Anna sleeps. In her dream, her father is reading her a bedtime story. He has the book open on his knee, but he isn't really reading because he knows the story by heart. It's a very frightening story, but Anna doesn't want him to stop. Her father says that it is about a war that happened a long time ago, when the French invaded Russia.
"How long ago?"
"Oh, more than 100 years, Anna. You'll learn about it in history one day." "Once, long ago, General Hunger met General Winter. General Winter, as you would expect, was sheathed in snow. His fingers were daggers of ice, and where his boots struck the earth, they left blackened footprints in the grass. When he bent to smell a rose, his breath scorched it. But he loved roses, and rippling fields of wheat, and naked sun-tanned children. He loved them all, because he had power over them all. General Winter stood in his great coat of snow and greeted General Hunger, as all great generals greet one another, once enough of their people have died and they can open their talks. General Hunger, on the other hand, was not what you would expect. His cheeks were rosy, his hair sprang from his head, and his eyes were moist and bright. He was in his element. The two generals sat down on their chairs, planted their tall polished boots in front of them, and leaned towards one another. They began to boast of what they could do to their enemies.
"This is what I can do," said General Hunger. "I make their skin flake and crack at the corners of their mouths. I make sores break out on their lips. They screw up their eyes and try to focus, but they never see me. They don't realize that it's I who have changed their eyesight. I whittle most of them down to skeletons, but with some I play a trick and fill their bodies with liquid that keeps them pinned to their beds. What I like best is a big, strong, well-muscled lad of 18 who burns up food like a stove. You should come back and see him after I've been keeping him company for a few weeks. He melts faster than a candle in my hands. His muscles waste away. All those big, strong bones stand out. I can turn him into an old man. I can make his eyes weak and watering. I can loosen his teeth and his gums until a crust of bread will pull them out. No one eats himself up quicker than a fit young man. I turn old men into children, whimpering for food, and I turn 5-year-olds into old men. It's all the same to me if they're young or old, ugly or beautiful, and I make them all the same. I've seen a lovely young woman of 25 shrink back from the sight of herself in a mirror after she's been living with me for a month or two. If I can't finish them off on my own, I groom them for my friends. A little cold that wouldn't keep them in bed for half a day soon proves fatal when it visits them after I've been staying. I strip them of their thoughts. I take away their feelings. I get into their blood. I am closer to them than they are to themselves. They can think of no one else. My dear cousin, you've got to admit defeat."
"Very good,"
said General Winter, scratching his ear with a nail of ice.
"But now hear what I can do. I hide the earth so they cannot see a single shoot of green. I drive the sap down into the tree's roots. I search out everyone who has no shelter. I fill roads with snow. I cut off retreats. I block all movement. I ensure that nothing can grow and nothing can thrive. If they leave a hand or a foot uncovered, I seize it. I scorch their skin to red and purple, and then I blacken it. I make their flesh rot like the flesh of turnips when frost gets into a clamp. I harry them with wind, and I blind them with blizzards. I freeze the seas so they cannot travel. I blow through the holes in their windows. I make them slow and miserable and afraid. I cut off their water supplies and take away their light. I make them wade waist-deep in snow to find a handful of fuel. When they are ill and off guard, I creep into their beds and rock them to everlasting sleep. I send gales and ice storms. I drown them in mud. My greatest power lies in the fact that each year they forget how strong I am. In summer, when they lie under trees bathed in sunlight, they cannot believe in me. They make their plans, and they leave me out. But I have already made mine, and mine are always the same. So, cousin, what is hunger without winter? Without me, they would be able to eat the green shoots and catch fish from the streams. Without me, the sun would keep them warm.
General Hunger frowned and folded his arms. His face was dark with thought.
There is something neither of us have mentioned, he said.
He glanced around, but no one was listening. The two generals drew closer so that their heads were almost touching.
Without the help they give us, we could do nothing, whispered one general to another.
Yes, it's true. Without them.
The two generals thought of the armies gathered to do their work for them. General Hunger broke into a smile and slapped his thighs with meaty palms.
Let's join forces, he said. What one of us misses, the other can take care of. Together we will be invincible.
And the two generals stopped arguing. The talks were over. From that time on, they have always worked together.
Who wrote that story, Daddy?
I wrote it down, Anna. But I didn't make it up. It's a true story.
Inside Anna's dreaming flesh, the child stares at her father. Anna twitches as if a mosquito has bitten her, and turns over in her sleep. The next morning, Sunday morning, the weather stays fine. Little Mitya Sokolov comes over to play with Kolya while Anna finishes her mending. Two shirts of her father's, her red blouse, and that pair of last year's shorts, which will do Kolya for another summer if she patches the seat. She can hear the children's voices from among the trees, where they're building a camp. Her needle flashes in and out with quick, impatient stitches. Her father's poking about with a bit of guttering which has come loose. She'll go and give him a hand in a minute, because she's pretty sure he hasn't got a clue what he's doing. But it's good to hear him whistling like that. She'll just finish Collier's shorts, and then she'll have a hunt for the twine. That'll fix the guttering for the time being, at least, and stop it clattering at night when the wind blows. But where did she put the twine after she'd finished using it in the garden? This is when she hears Mitya's mother yelling,
Mitya! Mitya! Mitya, where are you? Come here this minute!
Stupid woman. What's she bawling like that for? She knows perfectly well Mitya's up here, playing with Kolya.
Mitya!
The voice rises to a panicky shriek. Anna bundles up her sewing and runs to the veranda steps. Something's wrong. An accident. Darya Alexandrovna? But the woman is so out of breath she can't speak. She must have run all the way from the farm. She's fat, like all the Sokolovs, and she smells powerfully of sweat. There are beads of it on her broad forehead. Her breasts heave under her overall. Mitya's fine, Darya Alexandrovna. He's only playing with Kolya. Look, they're just over there. I thought you knew he was up here with us.
Haven't you heard? Haven't you heard the radio?
No.
It's war. They've attacked the devils just when we weren't expecting them.
Looking terrified, Darya Alexandrovna wipes her hand across her mouth, as if to spirit away the words that have just left her lips.
War? Don't you understand?
The Germans?
Of course it's the Germans. You don't think we'd be attacking ourselves, do you? They're dropping bombs on us already, the bastards.
Anna stares up at the clear blue sky.
They've bombed Kiev, gasps Darya Alexandrovna, words tumbling out of her mouth like betrayed secrets. Holy Kiev, would you believe it? And other cities, they say. It was Molotov himself who told us.
Molotov? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. Wasn't it I who heard it? Bombs and shells dropping on everywhere.
But the perfect sky is empty. War doesn't belong here in the country.
War. Everything will change. The children.
The children's voices are piercing.
No, Mitya, that's my piece of wood. You've had your turn.
A tussle. A wail of rage.
It's not fair.
I'd better sort them out. But Darya Alexandrovna detains her, pressing a hand on her arm.
At least they're the age they are. My Mitya and your Kolya. They're too young to get dragged into it. But my nephew, you know Avasya? He's your age, 23. God alone knows where they'll be sending him off to.
The image of Vasya rises in Anna's mind. Plump buttocks straining the cloth of his too tight trousers, stiff bristles of blonde hair, and little cunning grey eyes. The Sokolov, all right. He'll look after himself.
I'm sure Vasya will be fine, Darya Alexandrovna.
It's always the same, mutters Darya Alexandrovna. So high up one starts things, but it's us who have to finish him off.
And she glares at Anna as if suspecting her too of being a high-up one who will expect Darya, Vasya and the whole tribe of the Sokolovs to put right her mistakes. Then she goes pale, obviously realizing that a different construction could be put on her words. She's dropped her guard in the panic of the moment.
No offence, mind. When I say high-up ones, I don't mean anything by it. You know that, Anna Mikhailovna.
I know. It's the shock. You don't know what to think.
They'll be swallowed up, those fascists, that's what they'll be. They won't get away with it. Our lads will soon beat them off under Comrade Stalin's leadership.
Of course, says Anna mechanically. She knows this is not the way Darya Alexandrovna really thinks or talks. It's just the usual stuff everyone has to spout the whole time. Like the way old people in the village thank God every second sentence if they haven't been taught how backward it is.
Luckily, the words form themselves into clichés so naturally that you don't even have to think about it.
Out here in the country, those words sound even more grotesque than they do in the city.
Darya Alexandrovna's right when she says we weren't expecting the Germans.
But why weren't we? Why didn't those high-up ones know anything? They know whose stories should be published and whose not. They even know people's thoughts. They know that Olya's got to lose her job and hang around the bread queues like a ghost, but they don't know that the German army's about to drop bombs on us.
And here comes her father, hesitating when he sees Darya Alexandrovna. He doesn't like her, and she doesn't like him. Writers are useless articles, in her opinion. Her father holds a broken bit of guttering in his hand.
Anna Mikhailovna, says Darya in a hurried undertone, I don't reckon I'm going to be able to oblige you with that honey after all.
But it's the bees.
I ought to have told you before, our bees have not been doing as well as they should. It's those late frosts. We had to light fires in the plum orchard to drive the frost away. I thought we'd have honey to sell this year as usual, but the way things are, we're going to need it all for the family.
I bet you are, thinks Anna.
Dark, rich honey full of calories and vitamins. Honey that will last all winter. You'll keep it for yourselves. You're not stupid.
But I am. What a fool I am, wasting time, standing here talking to you. We ought to be back in Leningrad, looking out for ourselves the way you are.
They'll all be in the streets by now, stripping the shops bare. There'll be nothing left.
If Dad takes Kolya, and I get back as fast as I can on the bike.
Father, she says, we must leave straight away. We've got to get back to Leningrad as soon as we can.
Chapter 6. Extract from the diary of Mikhail Ilyich Levin. 30th of June.
It never ceases to amaze me that people can hold two completely opposed beliefs at the same time without feeling the slightest sense of contradiction. We are told that there is no real threat to the city. The bulletins may not be good, but that's only temporary. Our forces will turn back the German aggressors and run them all the way to Berlin. And we both believe this. And don't believe it. The locusts have already settled on the shops, stripping the shelves clean of oil, buckwheat, sugar, dried peas, tinned goods, anything that will keep. Prices in the market are doubling and trebling. My poor Anna was beside herself when we got back from the country to find the local shops already empty. However, she's made up for it since, peddling from one side of the city to the other, bargaining in the market, chasing each fresh rumour of a sausage delivery. Usually these turn out to be only rumours. If the goods actually exist, they are much too expensive for us to buy them. The banks closed down as well because people were taking all their money out in order to stuff it under their mattresses for the duration. Although they've reopened now, you can't withdraw more than a certain amount. But for a while, nobody could get at their savings at all, not a single rouble of it. We've got no savings left anyway, but it was depressing to see such crowds. Their faces animal and desperate, waving their passbooks, fighting past each other to get to the bank doors. For once, our lack of money was a blessing.
Imagine if I'd felt it was my duty to Anna and Kolya to shove everyone else out of the way and yell and bang on the bank doors along with the rest of them until I was chased off by the police. You have a certain idea of yourself, what you'll do and what you won't do. It's hard enough to hold on to it.
Anna doesn't know whether they'll keep the nursery open or not. People have been sending their children out of the city since the first Sunday, and now organized evacuation is starting. No one seems sure where the children are going. South of the city somewhere, out in the country, where they'll be safe from the bombing. But Kolya is staying here. I haven't got the slightest faith in our organization. There'll be some sort of muddle, that's for sure, and I don't want Kolya caught up in it. We're waiting, all of us, to see what happens.
Why do I keep writing we? I don't know. These past years I'd come to believe that we had finally disintegrated. Fear does that. And by the time we got to the Yezhovyes, we hardly dared to be human in public. Old friends made excuses when they met you on the street, or they scuttled past you heads down. You'd ask for news of a former colleague. There'd be a quick glance round, perhaps a whispered, "Haven't you heard?" And you'd know that your colleague had evaporated.
But here we are, looking into the face of something even more terrifying than the misery we've been able to pile up for ourselves. We scurry about, like ants with a stick poked into their ant heap. Why the stick's been poked, we don't know. But our lives and houses are upside down just the same. That's what war means. Blunders and muddle. And doing things without understanding why you're doing them. A long time later, if you're lucky, someone comes along and writes things down so that they make sense and calls his story history. This I should not be writing down. How can a man with children be so criminally irresponsible? But there's something deep within me that says, write whatever happens. So I keep on writing. I have a little place under the floorboards, big enough to hold a couple of these notebooks. There's a rug over the floorboards and a table covered with work planted on top of it. Anna would never dream of disturbing my work. We've had a few siren alerts, but no bombing so far. Everyone's talking about London and the aerial bombardment there. Are we going to get the same? The barrage balloons are up. There are firefighting units being trained everywhere, and every apartment block has a kid perched on the roof with a bucket of sand to throw onto incendiary devices. Anna is on the firewatch rota for our building. Nothing stops her. When she gets back from scouring the city for food, she starts pasting paper strips crisscross over all the windows according to instructions. Her rooms aren't exactly gloomy, but it's nothing like the light of a June day. Anna and Kolya sleep in their clothes in case of a raid, but I still get undressed. I sleep badly anyway. Why make things worse? If there's an air raid, who's going to care about Mikhail Ilyich's patched vest? We'll be too busy making our way to shelter in an orderly fashion. There aren't enough places in the air raid shelters, though, so I doubt if I'll bother to go. And yet nothing happens. We're all waiting. Was it like this in London? Leningrad still floats in its usual sea of summer calm. Any minute now the bands will strike up in the parks, the ice cream girls will come out, and everyone will start talking about swimming and rowing and berry picking in the forest. That still seems like reality. War is the dream from which we could wake if we made enough effort. This morning I went out at 5 o'clock and walked along the embankment, then down the Nevsky. I walked for hours, it seemed, but I wasn't hungry, and I didn't grow tired. I couldn't have swallowed anything, not even a sip of tea. I must write this down, although it's almost impossible to put into words. These heightened states all sound banal once you write them down. For instance, there's nothing more tedious than lovers writing about being in love. You need to be outside the experience, not caught inside it. And for once, it seems I'm caught inside. But this is what happened as I walked. The last years fell away. I saw only our city, as it always was and always will be. It was as beautiful as before,
but it wasn't fierce any longer, or proud. Rather than crushing us down, it seemed to be asking for our protection. Everything looked newborn, as if the city had dipped itself into the waters of the Nyevar overnight and then risen again, naked and vulnerable, with water streaming from it. As if to say, "You know that all my masterpieces are built on bones, but I am human too." Even the columns of the Kazan Cathedral no longer looked like elephants' feet ready to crush the human ants that run this way and that way, trying to escape. I stood there for a long time, looking at Kutuzov's statue. There he was, with his sword still pointing at Napoleon's army, ready to drive it back. And he drove it back. He played his part. He saved Russia, there's no arguing with that. Kutuzov, along with General Hunger and General Winter. There were just the two of us, me and Kutuzov. "It's all very well for you," I thought. I may even have said something aloud. "You are stone. You are safe inside history. But we are still flesh, trapped in a present we don't understand and being shoved towards a future we can't predict. The times are scared, and so are we. If only I could forget what human blood smells like. Hot and rank." And then after a while, as it sinks into the ground, it changes and begins to smell of iron. "You knew all about that, didn't you, Kutuzov? All those men you ploughed into the earth, like a farmer. We have to face the Germans this time, instead of Napoleon's army. More blunder and muddle, and who can tell how it's all going to turn out?" "Maybe you know, Kutuzov. Maybe that's why you're still holding out your sword." I'd have liked to shout up to him. "What's going to happen, Comrade Field Marshal? Do you know, up there? You're still with us, aren't you? With us all the way." And perhaps those stone lips would have moved. But you don't do such things, unless you want to get carted away. The Black Crows are still out on the streets, never mind about the German advances. Police business goes on as usual, and once they get you into one of those vans, you don't come out again. All the same, I found myself smiling as I walked on. Me and Kutuzov, eh? Each step I took seemed to give me the strength for 100 more. Well, all very high-flown, isn't it? The upshot was that I came home and told Anna I'd decided to report for duty on the Luger line with the People's Volunteers. Even an old man whose stories are unpublishable can dig a tank trap. The Luger line's where we'll hold them, if we hold them anywhere. Strange how the name of a river can suddenly turn into a defence system. "The Luger line," we say to one another, nodding as if we've known it all along. "That's where we'll stop them." But the stupid thing is that I'm still elated. I still feel as if I'm walking through my city in the dawn and it's lying there, beautiful and naked, asking for my protection. Mine! As if I mean anything. As I said, it never ceases to amaze me that people can hold two completely opposed beliefs at the same time without feeling the slightest sense of contradiction. Whatever happens now, those frozen years are over. Anna has got hold of a kilo of salt cod and some smoked lard.
Chapter 7. The statues are disappearing. They are covered in sandbags or wooden planking. They've been carried down to cellars or camouflaged. Peter's bronze horse no longer rears above the city, smashing the air. His hooves beat against the sand which packs against him and the planks that mask him. The whole city is going into disguise, and its people are going into disguise with it, carrying pickaxes, spades and entrenching tools over their shoulders, smearing their faces with sweat and dirt, clodding their boots with mud. They've taken trams and trains out of the city to work on its defences. They sleep in hay, boil water for tea over twig fires, and bandage their blistered city hands with rags. Students, school children,
Women, old men, they're all here, digging for their lives. This is the Luga line. No one can imagine beyond it. River, forest, villages, shallow hills. Woods smell richly of pine resin, just as they've always smelled when Leningraders go out to the country on their summer excursions. There are the little huts, empty now. There should be peasant children clinging to their mother's legs, peering at the summer people.
Look, here's that fantastic place for bilberries. And didn't Sasha get a whole pail of horse mushrooms behind that grove of birches last year?
Little Sasha, staggering out with a pail so full the mushrooms bulged over the top and he kept dropping them. If they can't hold the German army here, it will drive straight on to the outskirts of Leningrad. There's nothing to stop it. Only flat, forested land, little hills, villages. Anna digs. She remembers a dam she built across the stream that runs by the Sokolov place years ago when her grandmother was still alive. And her mother, too. Someone was helping her. Who?
Vasya, of course.
Vasya Sokolov, long before he had whiskers like pig's bristles. That was when he was her friend, and they banded together to outwit his family, who wanted him to work on the farm every hour that they weren't forced to put him into school. Vasya used to come up and knock on the door for her to come out and play. The stream was running fast, with a winter's weight of water behind it, and the water was icy to their bare feet. It must have been early in the year. They built their dam of earth and sticks and stones, plastering more and more earth onto the structure, while freezing water gushed between their legs. Her hair flopped forward over her face. Her hair grip fell out and flicked into the water. She peered between the stones, trying to find it. Hair grips were hard to get hold of, she knew that.
"My hair grip, Vasya, can you see it?"
But he didn't hear her. He was watching the dam.
"It's holding," Vasya yelled as a pool began to swell behind the dam. "We've done it!"
And he screamed and hopped up and down on the bank, jeering at the stream that couldn't flow anymore. But Anna was watching more closely. Prickles of water were coming through the dam. As she watched, their plastered mud began to crumble.
"It's coming through! It's coming through, Vasya!"
And the water was spurting now. It swirled through a crumbling gap. Mud eddied, thinned, and disappeared. Anna slapped on handfuls of earth, but they flowed away between her fingers.
"Quick, Vasya, help me!"
The sticks began to move. Even the stones were going now, as the water elbowed away the dam. The water ran thick, muddy, fast. Their dam was gone. Anna is digging again. She's digging for her life, but the sounds and smells of summer keep confusing her. If there are wood pigeons turning over their sleepy song, surely someone will come soon and say, "It's all over. You can go home now. Spread out, have a picnic if you like, enjoy yourselves." But there's the crumple of artillery. Far off. Then suddenly not so far off. There are aeroplanes, like black crows, searching the fields for grain. By now she can spot a Junkers when it's still a pinhead in the sky. Anna thrusts her spade deep, turns up a spadeful of stony earth, throws it behind her, digs in again. There is a burning pain between her shoulder blades. Suddenly a roar rises from a group of workers hauling timber.
"Get out of the way, can't you?"
But it's not her they're shouting at. She digs on. Spade in, bear down, turn. Oh, they're butchering those trees. Her shirt's soaked with sweat. She's worried about one of the blisters on her hands, which looks as if it might turn septic. She soaked her hand in salted water this morning and bound the blisters with rag. But everyone's hands are raw with blisters. If you smear honey on, they heal quicker. Honey's an antiseptic. Position the spade. Bear down with full weight. Turn. Lift. Over and over, 100 times, and then 100 more, all through the long summer day, as long as the light lasts. They were on anti-tank ditches yesterday. Today they're back on trenches.
"All right, girls, you've reached your target here. We're moving on. You're being assigned to fortifications at the railway station. Get going."
Little Katya,
on Anna's right, scrabbles out of the trench like a kid who's afraid she's taken more than her turn in the sandpit. She's terrified of getting things wrong and drawing attention to herself. She doesn't realise that it's precisely her nervous quickness to obey orders which makes her stand out. But then she's only 15, so what can you expect? It's all right, Katinka. There's no big rush. Here, have a swig of my tea.
Are you sure? Don't you want it yourself?
I'm offering it to you. Katya's brought nothing with her. Only herself, and her small, rather delicate hands, which have certainly never held a spade before these past weeks. She was crimson with shame when her period started, and she hadn't got anything. Anna had to sort her out with some borrowed rags and show her how to wash them in the stream. Katya's blood unrolled and ran away with the clear water. Luckily, in this weather, everything dries quickly. Anna rinses out her own sweat-sodden shirt and underwear every night and sleeps in her jacket. Katya takes a small, polite sip of the cold tea. Go on, have some more. The sugar will give you energy. But by now, Arkady Konstantinovich is looking for blood.
Do you ladies think this is a tea party? He scorches them. Get your backsides over here now. Get in line.
They stumble over the rough ground. It's a couple of kilometres to the station, but at least they're not digging. A change of position is as good as a rest. With your spade slung over your shoulder, a different set of muscles takes its turn to ache. Not a tea party. Anna glances at Katya, at Yevgenia beyond her, at the whole line of them tramping forward, boots caked with earth, hands wrapped in rag bandages, sunburnt faces streaked with mud and sweat. Hair is tucked into scarves or plaited and pinned out of the way. As their line advances under the trees, shadow dapples them. Yevgenia's red hair sparks, then dims as she goes on into the shade of a fir tree. What a lot of different colours there are in red hair when you look at it. Rust. Copper. Black. Yevgenia's sleeves are rolled up, showing strong, creamy arms which the sun has splashed with freckles. As she works, her strength and bulk become grace. No one can dig out a section of trench faster than Yevgenia. She doesn't hurry. She doesn't grunt with effort. She makes her way look like the only possible way of digging a trench. Why is it that some people make you want to watch them, while others, like Katya, have the effect of chalk squeaking up a board? Katya is pretty, unlike Yevgenia. Her fair hair can't help escaping from its plait and curling around her small face. It's one of those rosebud faces which don't stand up well to dirt and exhaustion. Her eyes are frightened. She stiffens when she hears shellfire, and she's terrified of enemy planes. No wonder, when the first thing she saw on her way here was a girl about her age, stitched to the ground by bullets. She hadn't made it into the ditch with the others.
They just left her there, Katya told Anna. They didn't even put anything over her. We all had to file past her.
It's all right, Katinka, Anna soothes her now. They're miles away. You can tell from the sound of the engines. Katya gives her a pitiful, grateful smile. At least it's as easy to cheer her up as it is to frighten her. She ought to be at school, frowning over her geometry like a good girl. Instead, she's here, along with every Leningrader who's capable of holding a spade, and plenty who aren't. God knows how many thousands there are altogether. You only see your own bit, but no doubt there are thousands of Annas and Katyas and Yevgenias stretching out for miles and miles along the Luga line. Everything becomes normal so quickly. It's normal to get up at dawn and queue for the hastily dug latrines and not mind if someone else is peeing alongside you. It's normal to sluice your face in a stream, bundle your hair into a headscarf, gobble down a couple of slices of bread, and stumble to work. Your eyes are bleary. Your back aches. Your arms ache. The muscles in your neck burn. But just get going and you'll soon warm up. That's the way to deal with stiffness, Yevgenia says. Work your way through it. Just keep on digging and don't give yourself time to think about it. It's normal to run for cover at the sound of aircraft. It's normal to see someone who didn't move fast enough, sprawled in a ditch.
Sprawled there, they look as if they're still running for shelter, deep into the earth. But when you pick them up, they have a strange, warm floppiness, and their heads fall back. There are two realities now. There are summer trees, flights of startled birds, the smell of honeysuckle in the depths of the night. This is the old reality, as smooth as the handle of a favourite cup in your hand. And then there's the new reality, which consists of hour after hour of digging and seconds of terror as sharp as the zigzag of lightning. Lightning that's looking for you, seeking out warm flesh on the bare summer fields.
"We could die out here," Katya cried the first time the planes came over. She stared in horror, as if it had never occurred to her. "Someone is trying to kill me. Me, Katinka, with my top grades in physics and chemistry. Me, with my ambition to become a doctor. Me, with my new summer dance dress waiting at Gostiny Dvor."
"Yeah," replied Yevgenia sarcastically. "Ain't that a shame?"
And she went on shoveling earth. When they reach the railway station, they fall out immediately and begin work. Anna is assigned to a work group which is to dig a tank trap on the station approach. There's rubble to be cleared first, and a stretch of wall to be knocked down. An older woman with glasses and grey hair begins to recite as she swings her pickaxe into the side of the wall.
"And so he brooded. From here we shall menace the Swede. Here shall we raise a city that will taunt our haughty neighbour."
"Pity it isn't the Swede this time," someone else interrupts. "They were nothing compared to these fascist bastards."
"Oh, don't spoil it. Let her go on," other voices shout.
"Nature has fated us to cut here our window onto Europe, gain our foothold to stand firm by the sea."
"Only the window's got broken and now the rain's pissing in," mutters Yevgenia in Anna's ear.
But as the recitation continues, surely Yevgenia is working even more powerfully than before, her redhead sweat staining her shirt. Working alongside her, Anna smells Yevgenia's sharp, foxy scent, which seems to belong to the forest and be part of it. Trains are still leaving from here, taking evacuees to the northeast, out of the danger zone. A crowd of kids is being bundled onto one. Kids are packed into every corner of the carriages. Kids are jammed against the windows. They're being taken back to Leningrad again, having been evacuated out here for safety at the end of June. Evacuated straight into the path of the Germans, as it turns out. The children are dressed in layers of clothes which are much too thick for the weather. This is how their mothers must have dressed them for the first evacuation, so that they'd have their